It is a take three, Lorraine Loughman, on March 31st, 1990. Hey, Lorraine, tell me about your daughters. Are they feminists? And what is their consciousness level like?
Well, I think Teresa, the older daughter, I know she has a consciousness. I know she recognizes things. It's easy for she and me to talk about incidences that are good examples of oppression of women in her own life and things that come up. She's not a working feminist, but she's not in the movement. She really is aware of discrimination against women, and she can be vocal about it. She is married to a very, very nice, very passive kind of man. Feminists tend to marry passive men. It's interesting. And he's a meat cutter for the Stater brothers. And they have a little boy. He's just a year old. And she does child care. When she works, she does child care. Very good with children. And otherwise, she's a homebody. And at some point, I'm waiting for her to get totally bored. And then we'll see what happens. She wants more children. My other daughter, Andrew, the other one, Andrew knows what I do. And she and I had a very difficult time also when she was a teenager. And she would go out of her way to make me feel bad in front of people. Mother doesn't know anything. Oh, you're just my mother. You don't know anything. And then gravitate to some other woman around. And although she doesn't do that anymore, and she does have a much in-depth understanding of what I do and what I have done, and has said to me, Mother, I'm really proud of you. And then she will bring people over to introduce them to me. It's kind of a little embarrassing. What is that? Come on. all mothers have things of value that we should all be proud of. Well, anyway. Andrea does not like to talk about feminism. She does not like to talk about discrimination against women because I think she still vacillates with the idea that if you try hard enough, you can overcome. And that if oppression comes, if discrimination comes, a lot of it's your own fault. You didn't do it right. Now, Andrea is 22. I keep saying, sociologists tell us when she's 29, she'll get it. Maybe I'm rationalizing. Anyway, I'm hoping she'll get it. Well, Andrea has also grown up very sheltered. And is herself a contradiction. She's grown up in a feminist environment. She's got a really sweet dad, a wonderful grandmother, and hasn't really been kicked in the teeth all that much. She's got two older brothers who have always looked out after her, who are really nice guys, an older sister, and a strong mother, and Andrea's a lesbian. Her contradiction that I see, that she hasn't made, is that in order for Andrea to be a lesbian today, her family totally accepting, her mother totally accepting and supportive of her lifestyle and of her, and have a family, at least, she does talk with me about various things, and we can be open enough so that when she has to protect her lifestyle, she has somebody who understands, and there's this contradiction. So at the same time, she just assumes that it just all happened.
Is she protected very much? Is she out most of the time?
Some of the time she's out, and some of the time she's not. At work, she's not out. And softball, she depends upon who she's playing with. It just depends on where she is. It's really an interesting contradiction that I'm hoping she'll recognize that one day, at some time. I mean, you can't say there is no, that the oppression of women is women's fault, blaming the victim, and then at the same time say, well, I have benefited by the women's movement, which she has. She can be who she is today in an accepting family, in an accepting community, great community, because of the work that I do, because of the work like of women like me.
Are her friends Iranian feminists?
None of her friends are feminists. No. Which is real interesting to see. Yeah.
Okay, well, let's go back to the late 70s and kind of bring up to the present. What have you been doing with your life? What do you think today?
Today, present.
Like from 80, mm-hmm. the last decade, what have you been doing?
Okay. Much of my life has revolved around the work that I've done as part of the self-help movement, which evolved into women's abortion referral service, where we went to hospitals and set up hospitals to provide non-traumatic abortions for women in Los Angeles basin, to opening our own health centers, where we brought doctors in to provide various kinds of health care, including abortion and birth control. And we learned to be administrators, learned to deal with licensing and harassment of everything else out there. By the late 1970s, I was part of a book writing team that was part of the health centers, that came out of the health centers, and we've since written and published a variety of health education textbooks that are now, some of which I've published in other countries, in other languages. And then by the end of the 1970s, our philosophy, that ran our clinics was forced to change because of a more conservative government people coming in, so that we began to lose control over our health centers and our clinics. And the licensing and the health departments required doctors and nurses to provide a lot of the health education we were doing, a lot of the health services that we lay women were doing, and doing better. Okay. So that by 1981, we were running almost traditional clinics. A lot of us didn't like it. I hated it.
So describe a traditional clinic.
You have a medical director who is a doctor. The doctor makes all decisions. And the doctor can decide to do things that are anti-feminist that you don't have any control over. You want to fire the doctor? Who are you going to hire? I mean, where are you going to get another doctor?
Another doctor like me,
right? Or any doctor. We were getting harassment, and by agencies that had a lot of control by doctors. I mean, the health departments and the licensing people in California are controlled by doctors, and they didn't like a competition. So we were getting a lot of harassment, a lot of pressures brought to bear. We had undercover investigations that were being handled in totally illegal ways. And even though when we went to court and we won, we still lost because it cost us a great deal of money that hurt us financially. We had malpractice insurance as an example. Malpractice insurance is, at least at that time, was owned and controlled by doctors. And the doctors didn't want us to have malpractice insurance. They didn't want our competition. So they refused us the malpractice insurance. So we had to hustle to locate other malpractice insurance. And that was the best, the cheapest. Awful times. All of it showed that we were effective. We were doing the right thing. Okay. By 1984, I felt that it was no longer really necessary for me to be an integral part of actual operations of any health centers, that there were enough women, or that there should be enough women who want to be entrepreneurs and want to run women's businesses, and that this is where it really should be. It shouldn't stay with the founders. It should grow. And especially since I didn't want to do it anymore. It had changed. You know, and it was a good women's entrepreneurial organization. But I have always wanted to do the things that are going to make the real change. Okay. So by 1984, I switched from being administrative, from doing administrative work, having administrative responsibility at the at Orange County, at the health center in Orange County, Santa Ana, and went into Los Angeles and worked out of the Los Angeles office and worked on another level away from direct day-to-day clinic operations, day-to-day health center operations. I mean, a number of the jobs that I've done them all, including chief executive officer, you know, where I was a clinic administrator. I retrained the doctors, I retrained the nurses. I trained some doctors to do abortions, talking them through over their shoulder. I set up training programs for new health workers. I did a lot of the paper, I updated a lot of the paperwork and introduced new paperwork. I was financial director for a long period of time, supervising bookkeeping end of it and money. A whole bunch of stuff. I mean, I've been involved in a whole bunch of stuff. Okay. I went into Los Angeles and we had restructured. Los Angeles and Orange County began to work more closely together, and I worked on another administrative level that was strictly in the office. That was policy making and overview. And I did that for a couple more years.
How many hours did you?
We were full days. They were between 55 and 65 hours. And this was a job at what we call the Federation of Feminist Women's Health Centers. It was an umbrella organization that oversaw sister feminist women's health centers that belonged to the Federation. Today there are three or four clinics in Northern California. There's San Diego. There was Santa Ana. It was Los Angeles. There's two in Georgia, that kind of thing. So I was working at the Federation level, the umbrella organization, for 2 years. And I worked very closely with Carol, who was doing that. And in order for me to work in Los Angeles, I got an apartment. I lived in an apartment during the week in Los Angeles, and I came home on weekends. And I worked like 55 to 65 hours, which was low, because when I worked at the health centers, administration, as an entrepreneur, you turn in a heck of a lot more hours. Small businesses always do. This is the thing that many women don't really get when we become small business entrepreneurs. Anyone who's an entrepreneur, a small business entrepreneur, has to put those hours in. I used to work as much as 80, 85 hours a week. Okay. So I worked in Los Angeles for two years.
Well, when you would have the apartment in L.A., you were putting your time, what would you do in the off hours in L.A.?
It was usually maybe 3 hours, 4 hours in the evening. I went back to the apartment, I had supper, I read a book, I took a walk in Hollywood where people say you're not supposed to walk, but I used to take a walk, and went to bed. And there was nothing to do. I mean, I just was tired at the end of the day. I might watch television a little bit, but usually not. Listen to the music, just go to sleep. I mean, I would leave work at maybe 6:30, 7 o'clock. Go in at 9, 8, something like that. Too long days.
How did this affect the
By then, he was very anxious for me to come back home. In fact, just going back, after 6 months of my being in the self-help movement, by winter of 1971-72, he was ready for me to come home. He had had enough of being primary caregiver for a bunch of kids and taking care of a family and cooking and cleaning, and which he never cleaned, but cooking and shopping and taking care of kids and washing laundry. It took 6 months, and he was ready.
No, you never came back.
Not on the same basis, no. I would come back, I would take leave of absence every once in a while and be back for 6 weeks or something, because things would get really, really bad at home. And I'd have to come home to begin to work things out with Al. And then I'd go back again, but it's never been the same. And even today, I have my own territory and people respect it. And I mean, I can walk away from here anytime that I want. I don't have to ask anybody's permission. I can go do whatever it is I want to do. And although today I'm in a different situation, because I'm what we call a sandwich generation. as a woman, that if we all live long enough, most of us go through. I have children who look to me. Okay? For better or for worse. A lot of times they don't look to me. But I have children. I have grandchildren who look to me and who I, from time to time, help take care of. I have aunts and uncles who are elderly. I have a mother-in-law who's elderly. I have a father who just died. He died here, moved in with me. I am that sandwich generation of woman who is, what, middle-aged, who's still responsible to people. Okay, I'm responsible for people on either side of me. And there's still no time for me. I'm also at that sandwich time where I have a husband who's getting older, whose health is beginning to fail, and he turns to the wife for help. So I have to keep an eye out on what he eats. I keep an eye out on any treatments that I can possibly think of that might help him. I do the homework, as usual.
Mm-hmm.
The mother's job or the woman's position. So I'm in this unique situation which I don't like, but yet needs to be done.
Yeah.
And it's been put on me. It's been forced on me. I have a sister-in-law who has MS. And she needs my help. There's nobody else in the family. And I'm leaving with her tomorrow for her to get some specialized kinds of treatment for a whole week up in the Monterey area. And I will live with her. And I will take care of her. She's wheelchair ridden. She has to be lifted. I will take care of her. There's nobody else to do it. I'm leaving. And in that sandwich position.
You wish that you could, would you change it if you could?
Yeah, I would want for more people to be more responsible in a more shared way than it falling on this middle-aged mother, this middle-aged woman in a family that everybody tends to.
Even now, you can know it's radical feminist activity. It's still, you know, that's interesting. I'm still
pushed into the same role. Yeah. And I'm doing the same thing that many, 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 many women out there are forced to do. And as a matter of fact, for many of these of us who are sandwiched, it is the straw that breaks the camel's back. It takes from our help, it takes from our resources, and when we begin to falter, there's no one to take care of us.
What would happen if you walked away from it all? I mean,
because I'm sure they'd get along. I'm sure they would. I won't do it. I can't do it. I mean, Al has a series of problems that he began to develop about, it was gradual. And about 3 years ago, it got bad enough that I had to do something about it. So I pulled on my resources. I talked to people, and I went down, and in fact, I brought them along with me. I went with people from the health center, the women. We went, took a bus trip down to Mexico to look at the alternative clinics in Mexico. Primarily for us to all learn, but also I was thinking in terms of him. Mm-hmm. And what we learned down there, he and I went down. I took him down there. He wouldn't have done it on his own. Then we spent a couple weeks down there. Then he got started on a program that I think has dramatically changed his life. But I also have to keep an eye out. He has skin cancer. He's had all kinds of surgery. We think it's under control now. He hasn't had any serious eruptions. He has had a gut problem, like many, many men his age. Early signs of very serious problems of his gut. We cleared it up in 4 days down there, 3 days down there. Boom. Hemorrhoids, goodbye. Bleeding, goodbye. Irritable colon, goodbye. 3 days. 3 days, 40. And he had something else that was going. Oh, yeah. He has they call it genetic or congenital you know when the blood vessel expands at one point like a bubble? It's called the I can't what it's called. It's not embolism, it's aneurysm. The base of his brain. He's getting very, very bad headaches. Top of his head. Mm-hmm. He finally went in and got all kinds of tests and they found it. It cannot be operated on. It's the kind of thing that can burst all by itself, and boom, it gets you in 20 minutes. Okay. What to do about that? What we've been doing, what he's been doing, seems to have brought that under control. He no longer gets the headaches, or rarely gets them. He feels better. So he may live.
Did he have to change his lifestyle?
And his eating habits, and getting rid of as much stress as he can. But it puts me in that position to be overseer.
So what are your days like now?
Okay. I continue to work with the Federation office on and off on what I call like special projects.
Mm-hmm.
When I stopped working at the Federation office in Los Angeles after those 2 years, I went back to Chapman College and I got my master's degree, and with the help of the health centers, and that was just really.
And what did you get?
I got the area is in human resources development with an emphasis in health education. So it's part of the teaching career.
Mm-hmm.
That's all part of it. Okay. It's a lot of it is management, which I can certainly do with just to keep things going around here. when I graduated from Chapman, all I wanted to do was nothing, and I didn't do anything. I mean, just no more involvement, no more. I took clocks down. I used to have clocks all over because I had to watch. I did not want clocks to determine my life.
What year was this?
This was, it was 86. Okay. 84, no, sorry, 88. I started, 84 to 86 I worked for 2 years. 86 to 88 I went to school.
And you took down clocks.
I took all the clocks. That was wonderful. It was just wonderful. Oh, God. And 88 to 89, I just didn't have any fun. I went to one or two conferences representing the health centers. I think I gave the paper at one of them. Last summer I went to Spain for the Federation. I gave a paper, made very good contacts, met some people who translated some of our book in Spanish without our permission. Dealt with that one. And pretty much just enjoying life. We go to Hawaii every summer now. And I just finished planning that trip. We're going for 2 weeks again this year.
What are you doing in Hawaii?
Up until this coming summer, we mostly have just enjoyed the beach, belly down, snorkel. Al scuba's, although he doesn't do too much over there. Just mellow out and visit the area, visit the volcanoes. We went over to the Big Island last year. And because lava flow was coming right down to the water, you could get very close to it, and we wanted to see, you know, just really how dramatic it was. And we have a condo in Maui, so we go over to the condo. That's really nice. And this year, we're going 2 weeks, and I told Al, I don't want to do anything. Nothing. Beach at 9 in the morning, light lunch at 12, take a walk, sleep, read. Afternoon, early light supper, steady by. I don't want to do anything. I don't want no tourism this time. I just, you know, beach again. I like the beach more than he does. He's very sensitive to the sun because of his skin cancer, and I tend to hold the sun better on my skin. And I could spend a whole day at the beach in water. I love it. It's just so relaxing. So, with my own life, pretty much what I've been doing, besides, as I say, just kind of whatever it is that I'm doing here as a sandwich mother. I have two grandchildren who come over to the house after school. One comes over at 11:30, the other comes over at 2:10. And they're here until Murray, their dad, picks them up at 5. They're here 5 days a week. On Tuesdays, one of them has a girlfriend over. On Wednesdays, they go to the library. I take them to the library for a program. On Fridays, one of them goes dancing. Ballet class. For a while, I had Bobby, the one-year-old, twice a week, 12-hour days from 6 in the morning till 6 at night. And won't pick up again until maybe next fall. So I've got grandchildren that we watch. Al helps quite a bit in that, too, because he teaches at night now, so his daytime is more flexible. As far as my work with the women, the women's health movement, it's pretty much like I was saying, on a project basis with the Federation. the Federation wants me to go back over to Spain to participate in a international women's book fair in Barcelona
mm-hmm.
in June, so I'm preparing for that. I'll be going over with another woman from the Federation, from the health centers, who's bilingual, who speaks Spanish fluently, which will help to know it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the main things is to make connections and share our books with people and, you know, see what they're doing. I'm also working up a new outline and an introductory chapter on some manuscript, a chapter of the original manuscript that we worked on when we produced books that we produced. The books came of different sections of the total manuscript. We still have manuscript that hasn't been published, and I'm working on one chapter which deals with hormones and menopause, and we're hoping to find a publisher who will publish, so I'm working on that. And I've pretty much agreed to work with the health centers on projects that do not require me to travel into Los Angeles anymore to work out of the LA office or any office. If it's anything that I can do out of my office, yes, absolutely. If it's different conferences that I can leave town for, and you know, I'll do that as well, or anything else on that line. But I don't want to go back to work out of an mm-hmm. office anymore, or be obligated for a certain number of hours, or certainly I don't want to travel on the freeway anymore.
Well, looking back, how do you see let's just talk about friendships. Your friendships now, how they change.
The friendships that I have now are totally an outgrowth of the women's movement. There are women in Orange County who I can call friends, I could call on if I needed to talk to somebody. I want to spend some time with people, if I have the time. There are women who I've met in my work in the women's movement, women's health movement, women's movement, who live here in Orange County, that I consider friends and who I know consider me as friends. And from time to time, certain ones of them and I do get involved on various kinds of projects on a very limited basis. And then we don't see each other for a while. Okay. Social friendships, it's pretty much the same women. Very few, but nevertheless the same women. I feel the same about the women that I've worked with and have grown close to who are part of the health centers. And, of course, that is a larger number of women. A number of these women are no longer at the health center, and they've moved on to do other things. They no longer live in Southern California. Some of them live back east. One of the women who works at the National Women's Health Network, she's executive director. Used to be director of the clinic in San Diego, Cindy Pearson. And, I feel like she is a good example of the quality of friendships that we all have developed over the years. I mean, I talk to her from time to time on various things that of mutual interest. And yet I know that I would be there for her, and she'd be there for me, that kind of thing. And I know it's an outgrowth of just all of our working mm-hmm. together.
How did you define yourself back in the 50s? And then how has that definition changed?
In the 50s, I was a woman of the 50s, just exactly a woman of the 50s. I was an immigrant family child who was first generation born American, grown up poor, with our family, the greater family, aspirations to succeed, which meant to grow up and develop skills and find a man who could be able to support me in a comfortable lifestyle, and so that I could also have children who would be well fed and well clothed, which I did. I did, in fact, find a man who is very stable and who makes a very comfortable living as a professor and is a good father and a good husband. So as far as those goals are concerned, I satisfied that for my family and myself. And I played the role that was dictated to me through the 50s. I did what, except going to school, which my father disapproved of, and my mother. I pretty much followed the role, including I got married as soon as I got out of high school. I had college rather, and I had four children, which at that time, four children was the ideal size family. So I had the ideal size family, and I was a Girl Scout leader and a Boy Scout leader, a Cub Scout leader, and I worked during.